This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Things We Wish Were True by Mary Beth Mayhew Whalen, performed by Taylor Ann Cron. For the Kayleys of the world, may you find a place to belong. Memorial Day Weekend, 2014. Sycamore Glen Neighborhood Pool, Matthews, North Carolina. Kaylee. Cutter and I were there when they opened the Sycamore Glen Pool for the summer, so I actually saw with my own eyes the spider web that was woven across the gate, keeping all the people from just walking right on in like they'd done every year. I knew neighbors shuffled their feet and sighed real loud as they waited for the lifeguards to figure out what to do. They held their towels and coolers and floats and bags and stared at the web as if they could burn it down with their eyes like superheroes. We all took in the large spider, round and yellow with black stripes, sitting smack dab in the middle of that web. It seemed to be waiting for us, as if it had a message to deliver before the summer could begin, like that spider in Charlotte's web. But no one wanted to hear that spider's message. All they could think of was how to get it out of the way so they could get on with their fun. Some of the boys grabbed sticks and tried to poke at the spider, the desire to destroy wound up in their DNA like we'd learned about in science class. They brandished the sticks like swords, content to fence with them when their mothers wouldn't let them kill the spider. I could feel Cutter beside me, wanting to join in with them, yet knowing he couldn't. His body was tense, his inner self trying to get over to those boys even as his arms and legs stayed still. I didn't say a word to him or make a move. I didn't have to. Cutter knew how it was without my ever having to tell him, much as he wanted to be. Cutter wasn't like those boys. Meanwhile, the girls huddled in fear, clutching at each other with more drama than necessary, shrieking so loudly that one of the lifeguards covered his ears, and the parents rolled their eyes and told the girls to be quiet. I didn't shriek, of course. I wasn't like those girls any more than Cutter was like those boys. So I just watched that spider, feeling bad that all its hard work was being knocked down. I hoped that no one would hurt it, that someone would stop those boys from killing the poor thing when the mothers weren't watching anymore. Cutter and I stood, two of us, off to the side, apart from the crowd. One of the lifeguards got a stick and used it to gently move the spider from its web, then let it down into the grass without causing it harm. A couple of the boys pretended to find it and stomp on it after he'd let it go. Then the other lifeguard used another stick to knock down the web, allowing the crowd that had gathered to get into the pool area. The web was quickly forgotten, and they ambled in as if nothing had happened. They slathered on sunscreen, cracked open beers, and pretty much ignored their kids while they caught up on all that had happened in the past 9 months. That pool brought this neighborhood together, but only in the summer. It rained that afternoon, and everyone had to run for their cars in the downpour, grumbling about a day cut short, calling out to each other that this was a bad beginning to the summer season. They ran out the same gate through which they had entered, forgetting that spider ever existed. Later I would think about that spider, wondering what its message to us might have been and how it might have made a difference if we had all paid attention. Zell Boyette made her way gingerly down the stairs, gripping the handrail, grateful for it. She used to just fly down those steps, her feet barely lighting on them as she rushed from one activity to the next. Book club, church, neighborhood board meetings, lunch dates with friends. John used to scold her, "You're gonna hurt yourself." She had hurt herself, but that was not how she'd done it. She did her best to walk normally as she entered the kitchen, where John was having his coffee at the table and peering at his computer screen, looking confused. He glanced up and saw her there. "Morning," he said. She poured herself a cup of coffee and joined him at the table, laying her hand on his. "You hungry?" she asked. They'd had some form of this exact conversation for the last 30 years. He shrugged. "I'll eat something if you make it." This was his standard answer. She hobbled over to the pantry. She could feel his eyes watching her and knew what he wasn't saying just as surely as if he'd said it out loud. John was worried about her knee, always bugging her to see a doctor. When he'd asked her what she'd done to it after it first happened, she'd told him she'd heard it running. That was close enough to the truth for it not to be a lie. She set about making them some granola and yogurt parfaits with blueberries, but a knock on the door interrupted her. The knock was light and hesitant, and one she'd become accustomed to hearing at least once a day. She opened the back door to reveal little Alec from the house next door. He looked up at her from under bangs that needed trimming. She should offer her grooming services to his father, tell him how she used to trim her own boy's hair when they were Alec's age. Lance would say no, wave his hands as if he were putting the final flourish on a magic trick that would make it all go away. He would assure her that everything was fine, that he'd been meaning to take Alec and Lila for haircuts. Then he'd get that anxious look that made her worry for him. The man was going to have a heart attack before age 40.
"Hi, Mrs. Boyette," Alec said. He attempted in vain to push his bangs from his eyes. "My dad said to ask you if you had any milk."
The boy shook his head and looked at the ground as if his father's ineptness was too much to bear.
"He forgot to get some at the store again."
Alec had been on her doorstep just yesterday asking for the exact same thing. She'd handed over her remaining milk, which wasn't much, then limped to the grocery store to fetch more. Part of her wanted to say that she couldn't keep supplying them with milk and other items, but the other part, the bigger part, knew that of course she would.
"Of course I do, Alec," she said, giving the boy a smile to put him at ease.
She retrieved the milk from the fridge and handed him the full gallon. Alec accepted the milk with a little oof sound, then cradled the gallon like a small child he had to protect with his life, the condensation from the carton wetting the front of his T-shirt, which already had a chocolate syrup stain down the center.
"Enjoy your cereal," she told him.
She knew those children were eating terribly. She didn't approve of Lance giving them sugary cereals, but he hadn't asked her opinion, and she suspected that, while he appreciated her help, he couldn't care less what she thought. But that didn't stop her from wondering what Deborah would think if she could see her children with their unkempt hair and dirty fingernails, their sallow complexions, and the little rolls of fat accumulating around their bellies. She fingered the belt on her robe. Not unlike her own stomach. They'd all changed since last fall. She waved goodbye, but Alec couldn't return the gesture with his hands full of milk.
"Thanks, Mrs. Boyette,"
he said instead, then turned to head home. And then, because she cared about the family next door, perhaps a little too much, if truth be told, and because of something in the way Alec's little shoulders slumped forward, as if the weight of the world were contained in that gallon of milk, she called after him, halting his steps.
"Will you guys be heading to the pool today for the opening?"
She pictured Deborah that first year after Alec was born, floating him around in the pool in one of those little baby boats. He'd worn a sun hat with a brim that kept flopping in his eyes, and he'd laughed a delicious baby laugh. Deborah had tipped her head back and laughed with him. Alec shook his head slowly, sadly.
"My dad says he has to work."
The words were out of her mouth before she could stop herself.
"Well, you tell him I can take you two. You tell him to come over here just as soon as he gets a chance, and we'll get it worked out."
He gave her an "Are you serious?" look, and she nodded in affirmation.
"Go on, go tell him."
She prompted him toward his house with her hands. She turned back to find John watching her, his face telling her all she needed to know.
"What did Oliver Twist want now?"
he asked. John pretended to be gruff, but he was an old softy.
"Be nice," she chided.
She set his parfait down in front of him. He raised his eyebrows.
"Did you just offer to tote those kids to the pool today?"
She shrugged.
"They wouldn't have gotten to go otherwise. Lord knows Lance doesn't have the time to take them."
He crossed his arms over his chest, gave her an impervious look.
"You better watch out, or they're gonna suck you right in."
She waved his words away.
"Oh, they are not. Eat your parfait." "I like my parfaits to involve pudding," he groused,
but he began to eat. After a few minutes of silence, John took a drink of his coffee and said, "So, I was talking to Clay Robinson. Seems they're in the same boat as us. Kids gone, nothing planned for the summer." She looked over at him, feeling where the conversation was going but not liking it. He ignored her panic look and continued, "We were talking about maybe going on a little couple's getaway." Zell didn't want to go on a couple's getaway. She wanted to go on a family vacation like they used to, rent a house on the beach or a cabin in the mountains by a stream, or stay in a hotel near an amusement park. She wanted to pick up wet towels and soothe sunburned skin and sweep up sand. She wanted to go fishing and camping and ride roller coasters and make s'mores and play board games. She wanted the summers of the past. She wanted to do it all again. But she could not say that to John, who still loved her, still wanted her, still held her hand when they drove somewhere in the car. This was, she knew, something. She lowered her hands to his forearms. He had such strong forearms. Even now she admired the way the muscles rippled underneath his skin. "What did you have in mind?" she asked. "I was thinking Lake Lure," he asked. "Somewhere quiet and peaceful like that. Maybe a little cabin by the lake." He grinned, proud of himself for thinking up this plan. "With a screened-in porch." She was a sucker for a screened-in porch, and he knew it. They'd been talking about adding one to the house for years, but with three kids to get through college, the cost had been prohibitive. Maybe now they could do it. "Clay and I could golf. You and Althea could poke around in the shops." Clay and John had been work buddies for a long time. She tolerated Althea, but she would never elect to vacation with her. The woman had the most alarming breasts. They looked like when her son stuck water balloons down his shirt to be funny. They hung absurdly low and moved independently from the rest of her. Althea also thought her only son looked exactly like Tom Cruise and used every opportunity to whip out her photos of him. This also disturbed Zell. She'd stood by once too often as Althea accosted some poor soul with photos while they nodded and agreed politely. "That sounds nice. I'll give Althea a call about it as soon as I get a chance," she said agreeably. She'd think of a way out of it later. Satisfied, John put down his coffee. "You know, I don't have to get to work right away," he said. She laughed. "I haven't even brushed my teeth yet." "It's not your teeth I'm interested in." He flashed his most charming smile, rose from his chair, and carried his dishes to the sink. He turned back and raised his eyebrows in invitation. She giggled and waved him away. He shrugged, then shuffled off to shower and get ready for his day. She went to the sink and busied herself with washing the coffee mugs and dishes from breakfast, half thinking of going upstairs to join John in the shower. Wasn't this the kind of freedom they once dreamed of having? Outside the window over the sink, something caught her eye, distracting her from her thoughts. A blue Mylar balloon shaped like a heart floated on the breeze, carried down their street as if an invisible child's hand were tugging it along. She stopped washing dishes and watched as it floated away. Right. The moment her eyes opened, she went into planning mode, listing the responsibilities of the day ahead. Opening weekend at the pool meant making sure the bags were packed, the lunches made, the meeting time confirmed with friends, the ample supply of sunscreen readily on hand. She lay in her bed going over it all, ticking off the mental bullet points. In the next room, she could hear Everett talking with Christopher about dinosaurs, going over the different kinds again, answering the same questions he'd answered dozens of times before. Christopher couldn't wrap his tongue around all the syllables and the long dinosaur names yet, and his mispronunciations were legendary. She could hear Ev laughing over Christopher's butchering of the word velociraptor. Then she heard the unmistakable screech of his impression of one. The sound of the two pulled her from the cocoon of her bed, pushed her toward her son and her husband, the nucleus of their family, her very center. "Mommy's up," Everett told Christopher. He gave her a grin over the top of the little boy's head. Their hair was the exact same shade of brown, their eyes, though shaped differently,
almost an identical blue. My boys, she thought, and her heart contracted with love.
Tell Mommy where we went this morning while she was sleeping, Ev prompted.
Christopher thought about it, his eyes lighting up when he seized on the right answer.
Whispy Cream!
From him, it sounded like Whispy Queem.
And what kind of donut did you pick out for Mommy?
Everett coached.
Chocolate with sprinkles!
Bright laughed along with Everett. She knew that her donut would be quickly devoured by a certain almost 3-year-old boy with laughing eyes and a love for dinosaurs. She scooped him up and pressed him to her, inhaling his early morning smell the same as she had done since he was born. He was her precious, long-awaited baby, the child she'd feared they might never have.
Hey, buddy, she said. What letter did Donut Dinosaur start with?
Christopher scrunched up his face, thinking hard. He was so smart, already linking sounds to letters, recognizing their distinct shapes. Behind them, Everett whispered, sotto voce, D. Bright swatted at him as Christopher shouted out the answer, as if he'd thought of it on his own.
D!
He crowed, then laughed, looking around in victory as his parents joined in with him.
I told everyone we'd meet them up at the pool around 11, Bright said to Everett. That'll give us a few hours before N.A.P. time, but one of us will need to go over and walk Rigby before we go.
Everett nodded in agreement and motioned her into the kitchen, where a donut and freshly made coffee with cream awaited her. He'd made a big deal on Mother's Day just a few weeks before, and Christopher had latched on to the concept of fussing over Mommy's breakfasts ever since. She wasn't complaining, but the thought of eating the sugary sweet donut nauseated her. She recalled those early morning sprints to the bathroom while pregnant with Christopher, how she'd both loved and hated throwing up. Loved that it meant that the baby was growing. Hated that her life had been taken over.
There is no turning back, she thought every time she crouched over the toilet and lost her breakfast. This is happening, she thought then.
But she knew it wasn't happening now. She thought of the conversation she'd had with Everett lately about Christopher getting bigger, how he felt they should start trying again.
Remember how long it took?
Everett had pressed her last week, as if she could forget. How could she tell her husband she couldn't do it again, that she wanted Christopher to be their only child? Could he ever understand or accept that? Would he still love her if she just said a firm, non-negotiable no?
As if reading her thoughts, Everett asked, You're thinking about what we talked about, aren't you?
He gave her that enticing grin, the one that could coax her into just about anything. It had been that way since they were in 9th grade, and he'd talked her into making out that one time during night games in someone's front yard, the other kids playing freeze tag and hide-and-seek in the dark, their disembodied voices calling out from the darkness. She'd strolled by that very spot just yesterday, now pushing their son in his stroller as she walked their elderly neighbor's dog. Another family lived in that house now, one of a string of families occupying and abandoning the house everyone called the eyesore. But she could still remember the way the house looked before the renters began destroying it. She could remember a lot about this neighborhood she'd called home all her life. She had not gone far, geographically speaking, yet she'd gone to lengths she'd never thought herself capable of. She thought of her solitary visit to the doctor's office, of the things she'd had to do after. She would never do those things again. Another child wasn't in the cards for them, and that was all there was to it. Now she only had to make her husband understand her resistance without explaining just how deep it ran. Everett was looking at her, watching in his wary way.
What do I have to do to convince you that this?
He gestured to Christopher sitting in his little booster seat, a ring of chocolate coating his mouth.
Is a very good idea. We can't have too much of this.
The bite of donut she'd forced herself to take turned to glue in her mouth. She took a gulp of her coffee, feeling the mass lodge in her throat, making it hard to speak.
Christopher was a very good idea.
She glanced at her son as she said it, ready to give him a wink. But he wasn't listening, engrossed in driving a toy car through the sprinkles that had fallen off his donut.
She continued, "But Juan's a gracious plenty right now. I mean, we've also talked about that email from work wanting me to come back, and with him starting preschool in the fall." She picked at what remained on her plate, scattering more sprinkles onto the table as she did. She could not look Everett in the eye.
"Mommy, you are making a mess," her son observed.
He pointed at the colorful sprinkles now scattered across the table and began attempting to get out of his booster seat, ostensibly to clean up her mess. She watched as Everett stopped him, settling him with soothing words and promises that Mommy would take care of it. She met Everett's eyes and blinked back her understanding. Taking care of things was her job. Jency. Jency swung into the McDonald's parking lot and navigated the huge SUV into a narrow parking space, throwing the vehicle into park with a flourish, projecting a confidence she didn't possess. She turned around to find two pairs of wide eyes blinking back at her, the looks on her children's faces akin to the time she took them to the circus, incredulity with a trace of fear. "You guys hungry?" she asked.
"We're eating here?"
Pilar, her older daughter, asked.
"Sure,"
she said. She tried to keep her voice light, breezy.
"Let's go see what they have."
Pilar rolled her eyes, trying out her newfound tween attitude.
"Mom, it's McDonald's. They have burgers."
"And French fries," Zara, her younger daughter, added.
She leaned forward, lowering her voice as if she were going to tell a secret.
"Can we get French fries?"
"Sure,"
Jency replied. She opened her door, throwing the interior light on as she did, the glow of it emphasizing her daughter's faces in contrast to the oncoming night.
"Everything that's precious to me is in this car," she thought.
"We can even get milkshakes."
She waved at them to follow her and climbed out of the car. Pilar opened her door just a crack and gave Jency a look that reminded her so much of Arch she had to look away. She fiddled with stowing her keys in her purse, right beside the roll of money Arch had hidden for her. She would have to use some of it to pay for this dinner. It was all the money she had left in the world.
"Mom," she heard Pilar say, her tone parental, "you never let us have McDonald's."
She turned back.
"Well, there's a first time for everything now, isn't there?"
She began walking, trusting that the girls would follow her. They did. Inside, they took their places in line. She scanned the menu, trying to remember what she used to get at McDonald's, back when she and Bright considered it a treat to go there.
They used to get the hot fudge sundaes, she recalled, with nuts.
She scanned the board and found they still served them. This brought her an inordinate amount of comfort. Some things didn't change. She wondered if Sycamore Glen had. Zara tugged at Jency's elbow to get her attention. She looked down.
"Yes?"
"Were you serious about the milkshake?"
she whispered.
Jency laughed.
"I was totally serious,"
she whispered back. She tried to catch Pilar's eye, but her daughter was ignoring her. She was angry about having to leave her home, her friends, her life behind. Jency didn't blame her. She was angry, too. Angry and sad. She thought of Arch behind the glass partition that had separated them, his mouth moving as his voice came through the phone.
"You have no idea," he'd said. "No idea at all what it took to keep all of it up."
His spittle had hit the glass, leaving a pattern, a constellation.
"I did it for you,"
he'd added, as if she were somehow complicit in his crimes. She'd turned then, hung up the phone that connected them, and walked away. If he'd said anything else, she hadn't heard it. Zara ordered a chocolate milkshake, and Jency added,
"Make that three,"
her voice full of false cheer. Pilar started to argue about the milkshake, but she gave her a look to silence her.
"We need this," she wordlessly implored her oldest. "Play along."
The cashier rang up their total, and she counted out the money to pay for it. A penny got away from her and rolled lazily along the counter until it fell to the sticky floor at the cashier's feet. The girl blinked at her from underneath a brown visor, managing to look both bored and busy as she waited for that last cent. Jency handed over another penny. Her life before hadn't included pennies. After their so-called dinner and a quick stop at a nearby station for gas, they got back on the road. She intended to drive straight through to her parents' house as the girls slept, the highway numbers changing from 95 to 40 to 85. She used to know how the highways were numbered, and now she tried to remember. Were the odd numbers for east to west or north to south? It had to be odd for north to south. Fitting. Odd numbers for this odd journey from one former home to another. She thought of the home she'd left behind, the yellow crime scene tape barring her from ever having access to it again. June 2014. Zell. Somehow that one impromptu offer to Alec Bryson on Memorial Day weekend had turned into a standing obligation. John had been right about her getting sucked in, though Zell was loath to admit it. 3 weeks later, she was schlepping up to the pool almost every day with Alec and Lila in tow, seeing to their sunscreen and snacks, hollering at them not to run, keeping an eye on them when it seemed the lifeguards weren't doing an adequate job. She scanned the circumference of the pool, hoping to spot a friendly face like she used to find whenever she came here with her own kids. Back then, she'd had friends, peers in the same boat as she was. They'd share sunscreen, slathering it on one another's kids without even noticing which child they were tending to. They'd make enough food to share, too, passing out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches that had fermented in the heat. On Fridays, they'd bring cans of beer and toast the weekend, sharing recipes for marinades and macaroni salad, the foods of summer. They'd sit together for hours on end, griping about money and children and, always, husbands. But it was the kind of griping that brought comfort, that told her she was part of something bigger. In those endless days at home, when she felt isolated and forgotten, she'd think of her pool friends doing the same thing in their respective houses and feel less alone. In the winter, she'd find herself counting the days until the pool reopened. They just didn't keep up with one another during the school year like they did in the summer. They were their own little summer society. This summer, she found herself lured back into the world of mothers and children, sitting on a lounge chair in the vicinity of these younger women. For it was mostly women still, in spite of all the advancements society had made, because that was where Alec and Lila wanted to be. Well, Lila did at least. Alec kept mostly to himself. She worried about him, wondered what kind of damage he'd sustained in all that had happened. She felt a presence and opened her eyes, squinting from the glare of the sunlight reflecting off the pool. Alec stood over her as if she'd conjured him up. He was still dry, and the intensity of his expression was so much like his mother's, she had to look away. He'd refused to get into the pool today, sitting off to the side and watching instead. "When are we going to leave?" he asked. "Well, Alec, we just got here," she responded. She pointed to a group of kids in the pool, all playing some sort of strange game that involved swimming from one side to the other very fast. "Why don't you go play with the other children? They seem to be having a good time." Alec glanced in the direction she was pointing, then shook his head. "Don't wanna." Zell spotted a young woman in the pool playing with her little boy, and wondered if that was why Alec wanted to leave. "Well, we just got your sunscreen on, and we haven't had the nice snacks I packed for us, and your sister seems to be having a good time, so we'll have to stay for a little while." Alec sighed deeply. "Okay," he said, then started to shuffle away. He stopped short and shuffled back. "Can I go over to the playground?" A note of hope had returned to his voice. They'd replaced the playground since her children were little. The old playground had been deemed unsafe, though Lord knew her kids had played there for countless hours and never been hurt. But parents these days worried about every living thing under the sun. It made her thankful that her children hadn't had their own children yet. She wasn't sure she was ready for all their rules and regulations when she kept her grandchildren. She'd heard stories about the special formula shipped on dry ice that cost as much as gold, the car seats that could practically drive themselves, The allergies and sensitivities and diagnoses, everything with a fancy name to it. This new generation of parents just had too much information, if you asked her. It was that internet, fueling their neurosis, empowering them. And don't get her started on all their devices, their heads bent down over their phones so much they could barely be sociable.
Can I? Alec repeated.
She glanced over at the play structure, a large wooden thing with all kinds of complicated platforms and ladders, but just two little swings located over the fence from the pool and adjacent to the neighborhood lake, which was really just a glorified pond.
I suppose so. Does your...
She caught herself. She'd almost said, Mom.
Does your dad let you go over there?
Alec nodded vigorously.
I'll be careful, he said.
Lance had at least gotten Alec's bangs cut, so now she could see his huge, brown puppy dog eyes.
Okay, just listen out for when I call you,
she instructed. He gave an absent-minded nod and walked quickly away. She wondered if perhaps he was putting one over on her, if this was something that Deborah would have allowed. She sighed and threw her arm over her eyes. Deborah had left, and Zell was here, so what Deborah wanted didn't matter anymore. It was Zell who was making sure their skin didn't burn, and that they got fresh air and had milk for breakfast. It was Zell who was worrying about Deborah's husband, and making her own husband cut their grass so poor, overloaded Lance didn't have to. It was Zell who was keeping one eye on Deborah's son on the playground, and one on her daughter in the pool. It was Zell who was responsible. Sometimes she thought of just telling Lance the truth about Deborah, but instead she focused on helping with the children. She told herself that was enough, because telling Lance the truth about Deborah would be telling the truth about herself. The lifeguard blew his whistle.
"Adult swim!"
he hollered, then climbed down out of the lifeguard stand with a relieved look on his face. In unison, the kids all groaned loudly and exited the pool, making their way over to where the parents had congregated, the lounge chairs clustered in odd arrangements that were far from the nice rows they started out in every day. Lila and two of her little friends came over to Zell.
"Can I have a popsicle?"
she asked, her voice sweeter than normal. 10 years old and she already knew how to manipulate. Her little friends hung back, wary, their bathing suits dripping steadily onto the cement.
"We didn't bring any popsicles, dear," Zell answered.
"The friends did, though,"
she gestured to the two girls with her, who tittered in response.
"They said I could."
"Well, I guess if their mother says it's okay, then it's fine," she said.
She reached into her pool bag and pulled out a bright orange visor with the name of some drug written across it, a leftover from one of John's many pharmaceutical conventions. She popped it onto her head. The sun was brutal. But her skin was getting tanner, and that made it all sort of worth it. She would have tan fat, at least. She looked down at the expanse of her stomach, housed in blue lycra. Too bad John's company never made a drug that made people lose weight without killing them in the process. The girls squealed with glee, their voices nearly piercing her eardrums, and ran toward where the mother of the other two sat. She looked as uncertain and out of place as Zell felt. Two chairs over from where Zell sat, a young mother walked back to a chair with a little boy, who was dripping wet and crying softly.
"This is Adult Swim," the girl patiently explained. "That means the mommies and the daddies get to swim with no kids in the water."
She pointed to the empty lifeguard stand.
"See? There's no lifeguard to protect the little children."
The little boy was not placated by this explanation.
"But I want to swim,"
he whined, his voice teetering on a tantrum. Zell recognized the warning sound.
"Well, right now we're going to have a juice box and some strawberries, and by the time we're done eating, it'll be time to go back in the water."
The girl's voice was sing-songy, as if she was attempting to sound kind, but bordering on losing it. Zell recognized that as well. Parenting might have changed since she'd done it, but some things were still the same.
"Excuse me," a voice interrupted her eavesdropping, and she looked up to find a nicely manicured hand hovering in the air between them. Reflexively, she reached up to take it.
Yes?
She asked as her hand was pumped up and down a few times. There was something familiar in the face that belonged to the hand, but she couldn't place it.
My girls are Pilar and Zara?
She pointed at the two little girls Lila had run off with. The three of them were wrapped in towels in a circle, eating red, white, and blue bomb pops.
Are you Lila's...
She let her voice trail off, uncertain just who Zell was to Lila.
Neighbor. I'm a next-door neighbor. Her dad was busy today, so I said I'd take the kids off his hands.
Oh, well, that's nice.
She glanced over at the girls and back at Zell. I think that Lila had invited the girls over to play, and I had said yes, but then I thought I'd better find out whether you would approve, but now I see that that's probably not possible.
Yes, I doubt Lance, that's a dad, would want extra kids over. He's working from home these days and, well, it's a bit of a difficult situation.
The woman gave a cynical laugh. Oh, I understand that, she said. Then, more to herself, added, all too well. The little boy a few chairs away delivered a belly laugh as if on cue.
What did you say your name was?
Oh, sorry. Where are my manners? Jency Wells. Zell squinted at her, trying to make sense of the different last name in the grown-up face. She had known a Jency once, a girl the same age as her son Ty. That girl had been the little queen bee of the neighborhood, calling all the shots and determined to take the world by storm. All the boys had crushes on her, including her own son, though he would never admit it. Then all that unpleasantness had occurred, and she'd been spirited away in the night by her parents, hidden away in some college up north. Zell heard she'd turned into a Yankee, married some man up there with tons of money, and hardly came home to visit. Folks said her mother, Zell's old friend Lois Cabot, barely knew her own grandchildren. Jency Cabot was a cautionary tale passed around among the grandmother set.
You're not...
Zell started to ask. Jency gave her a wide, false grin and said, a little too loudly,
Yep, it's me, Jency Cabot.
Well, Jency, how nice. You here visiting?
She asked.
I'm sure your mama is just tickled.
Yes, Jency said. We, came to visit.
I'm Zell Boyette. You knew my sons, John Jr. and Ty?
She almost said, I think Ty had a crush on you, but held her tongue. No one cared about that now.
Oh, sure, Mrs. Boyette. How are they?
They're fine, doing fine. JJ's married to a lovely girl. They're both building their careers and absolutely refusing to have any grandchildren for me.
She didn't mention Ty, and thankfully Jency didn't ask after him. Ty wasn't as upwardly mobile as his brother.
Well, please tell them I said hi, Jency said.
She glanced over toward the bathrooms with a grimace and took a step in that direction. Her girls were coming out, laughing and jostling each other. One of them turned on the outside shower and stuck her head under it, being silly.
Jency?
Zell heard the young woman with the little boy say, stopping Jency before she could make her exit. The girl was up off her chair and over to where Jency and Zell were in no time. She wrapped her arms around the startled Jency, then stepped back to give her a good look.
I can't believe it's you! You're here! You're back!
She marveled.
Right?
Jency asked, looking as stunned as her friend. Zell was witnessing a reunion.
Right, Bennett? I can't believe it!
Jency reached out and gave her friend another hug, then pulled back to give her a good look.
You're all grown up!
The other young woman, another child whose mother had once been one of the women Zell whiled away her summer days with, laughed and said,
So are you!
Zell couldn't believe she hadn't recognized her either, but now that she heard the name, she thought,
Of course.
You look just great, Jency said to Bright. I mean, really beautiful.
There was a note of incredulity in her voice, overshadowing the compliment, if you asked Zell. But both young women had all but forgotten she was there. Bright colored.
Thanks.
She looked down at the little boy hovering at her knee, taking the chance to veer the conversation away from the uncomfortable fact of her beauty. Zell remembered this girl as being sort of plain as a child. She'd certainly grown into the name. Light emanated from her now.
"This is my son, Christopher," Brett said. "He's almost three. And you? I heard you have kids."
Zell started to speak, to point out something that would loop her back into the conversation, to make her presence in their midst necessary. But she thought better of it. She listened to the two younger women talk, feeling superfluous, not unlike the discarded towels, the crumpled juice boxes, the wet footprints that appeared on the concrete, then just as quickly faded away. Jency. The girls were coming out of that dirty bathroom sans flip-flops, and she'd been about to go warn them, again, about the dangers of foot fungi when someone called out to her. She turned to take in this person who knew her name, her brain taking a few seconds to register just who she was seeing. She hadn't expected to run into Bright here, though now she realized it had always been a likely encounter. Bright had never intended to go far. Deep down, she'd known that this moment, or one close to it, would come. She couldn't wind up back in her childhood neighborhood and not run headlong into people from that childhood. In hindsight, taking the girls up to the pool might not have been the smartest move. But she'd been desperate to take their minds off things. When they were playing in the pool and making new friends, they weren't asking her what would happen next. And at the pool, she wasn't under her mother's watchful, concerned eye. Wright had married Everett. Of course she'd known that. Her parents had gone to the wedding, urged her to come too. "Bring Arch," they'd said, as if Arch's presence would alleviate the awkwardness. But she'd been nursing Zara and begged off, saying it was just too hard to travel with a nursing baby. It had been a lie that no one could argue with. She'd sent the happy couple an expensive silver tray. She examined the little boy holding on to Bright's hand, Bright and Everett's child. How strange it all was, and looked for a trace of Everett. The hair and eye colors were the same, but mostly he just looked like Bright. This heartened her some, gave her the courage to keep standing there making small talk with the girl she had once both loved and betrayed, and who had ultimately betrayed her right back. But could it really be called betrayal? Now that they were older, she wasn't as certain that's what it had been. She knew what real betrayal was now. An image entered her mind, Arch behind the glass in prison. The lifeguard blew the whistle, and she watched as the girls and their new friend dove back into the pool. Bright urged her to come with her into the pool to appease the little boy and continue their conversation. They gave the older woman they were awkwardly standing near a wave as they followed the little boy. She'd already forgotten his name, or maybe she'd blocked it out on purpose, over to the shallow area. She'd been thinking of getting in anyway. It was so hot and it was only June. She'd forgotten the heat and humidity of a southern summer. But she'd also forgotten her mother's tomato sandwiches, white bread, peeled and sliced tomatoes, Duke's mayonnaise, liberal salt and pepper, the way peaches fresh off the tree tasted, and chasing lightning bugs at dusk, the air at night as warm as midday in Connecticut. The home of her childhood could still offer the comforts of that childhood, comforts she welcomed.
"This is so great," Bright said. She looked at the boy. "Christopher."
Her voice dripped with the kind of gentleness only a first-time mother can muster.
"This is one of Mommy's oldest friends. We grew up together."
She looked over at Jency, seeking validation that her claim was true. Jency nodded and looked away, pretending to look for her girls even though she knew precisely where they were, on the little diving board. At their club back home, they had a high dive, a curving slide, a snack bar with waiters to deliver drinks to your chaise. She and her friends practically just held out their hands, and the drinks appeared like magic. She wondered if Bright knew the truth about why she was back. She had yet to hear that unmistakable note of pity she'd heard in the voices of her former friends in Connecticut, the unfortunate times she'd run into any of them before she'd left. She
She hadn't wanted to tell anyone what had happened to Arch, including her parents. But when it became apparent that she might end up needing her folks' help, she'd filled them in on all the gory details. Her father, good man that he was, had asked if he should come up there and kick Arch's ass. She'd laughed in spite of herself and assured him that no, his ass-kicking services would not be needed. The federal government was doing a fine and dandy job of that, thank you very much.
Just know we're here if you need us, he'd said.
The kindness in his voice had brought tears to her eyes. It had made her remember the support he'd offered before, back when the hearts had started showing up everywhere, and she'd had no choice but to go somewhere that her admirer couldn't find her anymore. It was her father who'd driven her up north, to a college they'd told no one about, since no one could figure out who'd been stalking her. They couldn't afford for the wrong person to know, the wrong person to find her. That had been a long, quiet ride, the radio on low, the mood in the car pensive, not unlike her ride back all these years later.
"I can't believe my mom didn't tell me you were here," Bright said, her focus intent on Christopher instead of Jency, which was a good thing.
"She probably didn't know," Jency said.
"Didn't know?"
Bright repeated as a question. She looked up at a plane making its way across the wide blue sky and nodded an answer to Christopher's incessant questions.
"I sort of asked them to keep it quiet, that I was here."
"Oh, no. Did something happen?"
Bright's face registered legitimate concern, but in spite of that, Jency couldn't tell her. She could tell Bright was trying to be her friend, but things weren't the same between them for a lot of reasons. She waved her arm in the air and forced a smile. "Just didn't want a big to-do. You know, after all this time."
"It has been a long time, Jency."
Bright's voice got quieter.
"I never thought you'd stay gone so long."
Though she tried to hide it, Jency picked up on the hurt in Bright's voice and attempted to lighten the mood with a joke.
"Well, you know, I met this man and I got pregnant. Oops!"
Jency grinned, expecting Bright to laugh, but Bright didn't even smile over her standard joke, which usually got a better response. She continued talking, her words tumbling over themselves. "So we got married and had the kids, and things were crazy. We made a few quick trips back, but we never stayed very long. It was easier to have my parents come to us." She took a breath.
"So what about you guys? How'd you end up back here?"
Bright watched as Christopher barely put his face into the water. Then she applauded as if he'd just swum the length of the pool.
"We bought a house here when I got pregnant with Christopher. Wanted him to have the same kind of childhood we both did. You know..."
Bright's words died on her tongue as she realized what she was saying. This wasn't a place full of happy memories for Jency. For her, this was a place to run from, not to. Bright recovered quickly, her voice confident.
"I mean, we love it here."
"Of course," Jency found herself saying. "It's nice."
She looked around at the handsome lifeguard on the stand in his risky business sunglasses, the rippling water, the assortment of children playing together, and the older woman who'd been so nice, JJ's mom. If she tried to recall some happy memories of this place, she might come upon them. She might see things differently.
"Look, Mom!"
she heard Zara call, and turned to see her youngest, most cautious child, standing on the diving board. Back home, Zara never went near the high dive or the slide, hanging out in the splash pool for babies instead, and insisting that was all she wanted. Maybe the short diving board was more her speed.
"Watch this!"
"I'm watching!" she called back brightly.
Zara sprang into the air and gathered her feet to her, forming herself into a compact little ball just before coming down with a loud splash into the water. All the other kids clapped as Zara popped back up to the surface, blinking to clear her vision so that she could make sure Jency was still watching. Bright. On the way back to her chair, Bright stepped on a discarded juice box, and the remaining contents squirted her foot. She grimaced,
and sat down to wipe it off with her towel. Her friend Karen had arrived with her daughter, Sarah, while she was catching up with Jency. Karen sprayed the child with SPF 100, coating the air more than the kid. Bright waved the mist away and handed a cup of water to Christopher, who was already whining that he wanted to go back in the water.
"We need to say hi to our friends," she coaxed.
She looked at Karen and sighed with exhaustion.
"Hi," she said.
Karen laughed and pointed over at Jency.
"Who was that?"
Bright smirked at her.
How to explain who Jency was? She didn't have the energy to go into it now, so she gave as brief an explanation as possible. "That was someone I grew up with. She's in town with her girls for a visit."
She made her voice sound light and carefree as she said it. Karen checked Jency out surreptitiously from behind her dark glasses.
"She's pretty," she said. "Really pretty."
Bright flopped back on the chaise.
"She always was," she said. "And besides, her kids are older. She has more time to spend on herself."
Karen pointed at herself.
"Don't I know it, this bathing suit?"
She gestured to the plain black tankini she wore. "When I put this on today, it was the first time I'd been out of sweats in 2 days. When Kevin wants to have sex, I'm like, 'Dude, have you looked at me? Have you smelled me?'" Bright laughed.
"Preach, sister," she said.
Karen began the arduous process of pulling the floaties onto her daughter's arm as Sarah twisted and whined.
"You can't go in unless you have these on," she said. "You know the rules."
She gave up when the floaties were just above the elbows instead of at the biceps where they belonged. She waved Sarah toward the pool.
"Let's go," she said.
She motioned for Bright to get up, and Bright moaned good-naturedly.
"I will pay you $100 to take both kids in the pool for 1 hour.
Karen shook her head vigorously.
"If I go, you go. It's the motherhood code. And besides, I'm the one who's pregnant. I should be the one who gets to lounge."
Bright didn't need reminding of her friend's current state. It was Karen and Kevin's announcement that had started Everett on his quest to add to their family. Ironically or not, Karen and Kevin's last name was Jones, and Everett was committed to keeping up with them. They passed the time in the water, talking about the latest neighborhood happenings, revisiting the same subjects they always covered. Should they resume bunk-own game nights in the fall? Who was bringing what to the 4th of July potluck? Would the women of the neighborhood respond to the idea of doing a painting class in the clubhouse once a month? And what books should they select for this year's book club when it started again in September? Karen was the energizer bunny of the WOSG, Women of Sycamore Glen.
"You think your friend over there would want to come to the book club?"
Karen gestured at Jency, who was, in fact, reading a book.
"Oh, she's just visiting."
"Got it," Karen said.
But she gave Bright a look that told her she'd responded just a little too passionately. Karen could smell a good story from 50 paces, and if Bright wasn't careful, she'd sniff this one out, too. Bright didn't need to share their complicated relationship with anyone. Bright glanced at the clock on the clubhouse wall.
"Ugh, I gotta go."
"But I just got here," Karen said. "You can't leave me."
She made a dramatic, desperate face and playfully tugged on her arm.
"I'd stay, believe me. But I promised Myrtle Honeycutt I'd walk Rigby."
"It's too hot to walk that dog,"
Karen argued, looking legitimately horrified.
"We'll drink lots of water and we won't go far, Mom,"
Bright smirked at her.
"Besides, if I don't take him, she will try to."
She shrugged.
"It's become part of our routine."
Karen poked her in the shoulder.
"You, my dear, are too nice."
Bright waved goodbye and pulled Christopher from the pool. As she collected her things, she glanced at Jency one more time, catching her eye and waving goodbye, wishing she could ask her so many questions, wishing the years hadn't turned them into strangers. Kaylee.
"We had a summer routine, Cutter and me. We got up, and I made Cutter some breakfast.
Usually it was just cereal, because Mom didn't like me using the stove when she was at work. But sometimes I made him toast, because I was allowed to use the toaster. When Mom got paid, she bought us Pop-Tarts, even though they are very bad for you and you should not eat them. It was only once a month, so she said it was okay. After breakfast, we did our chores. I cleaned the dishes and Cutter swept the floor, though mostly he just hit the floor with the broom until I told him to stop. Then we vacuumed or cleaned the bathroom or did something to make the house look nice inside. When we first moved in, I went outside and looked around for something I could do to make the outside of the house look nice. But I didn't have any money for paint or flowers or anything like that, so I decided to stick to the inside. I learned to just walk really fast inside the house, so I didn't have to see how ugly it was on the outside. I knew what people said about our house. I listened to the conversations at the pool when they thought I wasn't listening. They called it the eyesore, and they talked about how that house should not be in their neighborhood. Truth be told, I'd had the same thought the first time I saw it. Driving past all the pretty houses had filled me with hope that maybe this time things would be different, and we'd have the better life that Mom was always dreaming about. But that wasn't to be. Instead, we had to walk into that house, the one people looked at like a black tooth in the middle of a mouthful of pearly whites. Our house probably used to be gray, but it looked kind of white now since most of the paint was gone. It was basically no color at all. The bushes, if you could call them that, they were more like trees by then, had grown up so high they covered half the windows in the front of the house. Other than the overgrown bushes, there were no trees in the front yard, just scrubby grass, where there was any grass at all. And to top it all off, there were some shutters missing, and the mailbox leaned like it was thinking about falling over any second. The neighbors hated that house. They wanted to knock it down, and they weren't too happy about us living in it either, on account of how they could knock it down if folks would just stop renting it. The people at the pool said stuff about the kind of people who would rent a house like that. They said that we were white trash, and how they'd heard me and Cutter's daddy was in prison. But they were wrong about that. Cutter's daddy was in prison. I don't have a daddy. At least, not one I've ever seen. Our new neighbors didn't like us, even though they'd never met us, never came over and brought us a casserole and introduced themselves like people do on TV. The sign on the entrance to the pool said, "We're all family here," but that was just not true. I tried to tell Mom what people were saying, but Mom said it was a better life for us and that we'd just have to learn how to get along. She told me to stop eavesdropping if it was going to upset me so much. "My little Snoop," she said, ruffling my hair, "this is a good place." But she also said to keep the door locked, and reminded me about 100 times not to talk to strangers. A girl disappeared from nearby right before we moved in, and my mom was all freaked out about it. So, since all our neighbors were strangers, and that didn't seem like it would ever change, we didn't talk to anyone at all. After we finished our chores, we did our reading. I made a rule. We had to read for 30 minutes every day. Mom took us to the library when she could, so we would have books to choose from. I would get as many as my arms could hold, and Mom would say it was too many, but I would promise to read them all. And I did. Cutter always got picture books, and I told him he should get harder books, but Cutter didn't like to read. Sometimes when it was reading time, he would argue with me and say he wouldn't do it. I told him that if he didn't, he wouldn't get TV time, and he knew I meant it. So he usually went in his room and looked at the pictures, which made me happy, because I got to be alone in my room with no Cutter to pester me for 30 whole minutes. A good thing about the new house, we each had our own room. In our old apartment, Cutter and I slept in the bedroom, and Mom slept on a pull-out sofa in the den. Sometimes her boyfriend, Joe, slept with her on the pull-out sofa, and if I needed something from the kitchen, I had to walk past his sleeping self. I didn't like the way he smelled up our den with his oily man smell. I was glad when Joe went away. The best part about the house in Sycamore Glen, eyesore or not, was there was no Joe. After reading time was over, we turned on the TV. We alternated days of who got to pick what we watched. Cutter liked animal shows, and I liked reality TV. We were both happy with animal reality TV, like ones where they catch